Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 88.
Tangshan Zheng and his disciples, they've just delivered life-saving rain to Fengxian County. What's the immediate mood like? I mean, among the pilgrims, do they ride that wave of success or does something else quickly emerge?
You'd think it would be pure elation, wouldn't you? And Tangshan Zheng is absolutely thrilled. He calls it a greater good even than saving the children back in the kingdom of Biku. And he's praising Sun Wukong's, you know, incredible efforts. The text itself describes this as a good deed, right? Mm-hmm. With the rain soaking everything and saving tens of thousands upon thousands of lives. That original phrasing, kuen, it really emphasizes that overwhelming life-giving abundance. So yeah, it sets a profoundly positive tone for this next leg of the journey.
You'd think everyone would be basking in that success, feeling pretty good.
Mm.
But then, almost predictably, we get a classic Zubaji moment that completely shifts the tone. What's his immediate reaction to all this good deed work?
Oh, Baji. He doesn't miss a beat. Just as everyone's feeling good, he immediately starts complaining. Asks if they can't just stay for, like, half a year and let him eat a few full, comfortable meals.
Yeah.
And this scene, it isn't just comedic relief, though it is funny. It's a brilliant commentary on that constant tension between, you know, spiritual enlightenment and earthly desires. Baji really embodies the very real physical burdens of the journey. He highlights how even a divine mission is constantly tested by, well, human weaknesses and comforts. He even jokes, doesn't he? Implying Wukong is like externally kind, but internally mischievous, always tormenting him. And he lists his grievances, constantly being tied up, hung up, boiled, or steamed. It really forces us to consider, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is enduring hardship actually a prerequisite for spiritual growth? Or is it just an unfortunate reality of the path they're on? That's quite a list of complaints. Wow. He really holds a grudge, doesn't he?
So beyond their internal squabbles as they continue, the landscape around them truly paints this vivid picture of deep autumn. It feels like the text itself is giving us a sense of their journey through changing climes and, you know, the passage of time.
Absolutely. The descriptions are quite poetic. They really pull you into the season. We hear of watermarks receding, mountains looking gaunt, and red leaves flying, it being the time of yellow flowers. It truly paints a picture, this journey through time and nature. And then there's frosty, clear nights feeling longer and moonlight piercing through windows. Just lovely imagery.
And it's not just the natural world, is it? I was struck by how the text quickly brings us back to the human element you mentioned, the chimney smokes and rooster crows. It feels like a subtle reminder that for all their spiritual quests, they're still journeying through a very human world.
It does. Yeah, we get these wonderful glimpses of human life, homes with many chimney smokes at sunset, cold water flowing in lakes, and then the details of harvests and villages, wild geese landing in desolate villages among shattered reed flowers, and rooster crows in country inns announcing the harvest of beans. It grounds their epic journey in the everyday rhythms of life, you know.
After traveling for some time through this autumn landscape, a new city appears on the horizon. Tangshan Zheng, ever curious, is ready to rush in, but Wukong, with his pragmatic streak, suggests they wait until they're closer and can ask someone.
Right, and, you know, in Journey to the West, these seemingly chance encounters rarely are just chance, are they? Almost on cue, an old man emerges from a thicket. He's described quite simply just a bamboo staff, light clothing, palm fiber shoes. What do you think is the deeper significance of meeting this specific old man at this precise moment?
That's a great question. It's often through these seemingly minor interactions that crucial information comes to light, isn't it? So the old man identifies the place as Yuhua County, a lower district of the Tianzhu Kingdom, and the ruler, the Yuhua King, who's actually a relative of the Tianzhu emperor. And crucially, the elder says this king is very virtuous, specifically respects monks and Taoists, and deeply loves his people. That sounds promising.
It is, yeah. This information is absolutely critical for the pilgrims. It immediately signals a potentially welcoming reception, which is, you know, a stark contrast to some of the treacherous, demon-infested places they've encountered. So it frames the upcoming interaction in a remarkably positive light, setting the stage for what should be, well, an easier stop.
Okay, so once inside the city, it's a bustling, vibrant scene. Tangshan Zheng, ever cautious, immediately instructs his disciples, be careful, don't be wild. So Baji ducks his head, Shedkru Jing hides his face, but Sun Wukong, as usual, just supports his master by staying close.
And it's truly striking how the public immediately reacts here. People rush to see them, calling out, we only have high monks who subdue dragons and tigers here. We've never seen monks who subdue pigs and monkeys. I mean, that really highlights the utterly unexpected, even, well, monstrous appearance of the disciples to ordinary mortals.
And Baji, oh, true to form, he just can't resist a quip, can he?
Never.
He deliberately pokes out his snout and asks, "Have you seen a monk who subdues a pig king?"
Oh my goodness.
The crowd is terrified, stumbling and scattering, and Wukong, ever the one trying to keep them on track, quickly tells him to hide his mouth and not play the fool.
The humor here is just brilliant, isn't it? It showcases that constant tension between their divine mission and their, well, their monstrous forms. But despite the shock, the city itself sounds vibrant. It's described as a divine metropolis, bustling and prosperous, no less beautiful than Chang'e.
Mm.
And listen to this detail. The text even mentions the price of white rice and sesame oil. And the rates are incredibly low for the time. It signals a city of remarkable prosperity and abundance, where even basic goods were really accessible.
Wow. So they eventually reach the Yuho King's palace. Tang Sanzang, with his usual diplomatic protocol, instructs his disciples to wait at the guest house while he goes to meet the king and get his travel documents stamped. It does make you wonder, though. Why would he leave his powerful, albeit uniquely formed, disciples outside? Seems risky.
That's a great observation. It absolutely reinforces the diplomatic protocol needed in human kingdoms. Appearance and formal presentations are just paramount, you know. And Tang Sanzang knows his disciples' forms could be, well, startling, to put it mildly. The watchman at the guest house is described as being scared by their ugly faces, but he doesn't dare send them away, so they just kind of let them sit there. It's this moment of really awkward acceptance.
Right. So inside Tang Sanzang, he's changed into proper attire, presents his travel document to the king, and the king, living up to his virtuous reputation, eagerly welcomes him, stamps the document, and starts asking about his journey. Tang Sanzang confirms it's been 14 years, and that epic 108,000 li, that legendary distance prophesied by Guanyin herself. He also mentions enduring 10,000 twists and turns, 1,000 demons, just incredible hardship.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really underscores the immense difficulty of their journey, doesn't it?
Mm.
And the king's genuine appreciation for their spiritual endeavor. The king is absolutely delighted and immediately orders a vegetarian feast. And Tang Sanzang, ever mindful of his team, requests that his three disciples be invited to join.
And this is where the comedy truly unfolds. The officials go to summon the disciples, and when Baji hears the word "oh," which means vegetarian meal, he apparently just leaps up in excitement.
Yes. And the officials' reactions are absolutely priceless. They are scared out of their wits. They call Baji a pig demon, Wukong a monkey spirit, and Xiao Wujing, quite surprisingly, they call him a kitchen god. Maybe because of, look, it's hard to say. It's just this brilliant moment that combines fear, humor, and a glimpse into how these celestial beings are perceived in the mortal realm.
Scared out of their wits, indeed. You'd think they'd run screaming, but they actually deliver the message. And despite their, well, monstrous forms, Xiao Wujing calmly explains that they are Tang Sanzang's disciples, just trying to keep things calm. The prince, confronted by Sun Wukong, Zhu Baji, and Xiao Wujing, is immediately terrified.
Just like instantly.
Instantly. Their unique, shall we say, aesthetic strikes him as ugly and evil-looking, which frankly sets an incredibly nervous tone for their grand entrance.
Tang Monk, ever the diplomat, tries to smooth things over, reassuring the prince that despite their appearance, his disciples are good-hearted.
Bless him for trying.
But then Zhu Baji steps forward with his greeting, which is described as truly rough and crude.
Oh boy.
It further unnerves the prince to the point where Tang Monk scolds Baji, saying his single rude remark shocked Mount Tai. I mean, how bad does your greeting have to be?
It's quite a lesson in cultural etiquette, or rather, the complete lack thereof in Baji's case.
Right.
It raises an interesting point about how their unrefined nature clashes so starkly with courtly expectations. Sun Wukong, with his characteristic wit, even quips that he's glad he didn't try to greet anyone, saving himself the effort.
Mm-hmm. Typical Wukong.
And Xiao Wujing adds the telling detail that Baji was shouting before ready, perfectly capturing just how unpolished their approach was. Like, he just blurted it out.
Despite that rather awkward initial impression, Tang Monk and his disciples proceed to the Baiyosha Pavilion for their meal. But the initial unease isn't forgotten back in the main palace. Not by a long shot.
No, absolutely not. The Yue prince's changed face and obvious fear are certainly not lost on anyone.
People notice.
Especially not on his three young sons, who are described as warlike and strong, and they pick up on their father's distress immediately.
And these little princes don't hesitate, do they?
Not at all.
They immediately jump to conclusions, suspecting the monks are mountain demons in disguise.
Standard assumption when you see someone unusual, apparently.
Without a moment's thought, they arm themselves.
Mm.
The eldest with a staff, the second with a 9-toothed rake, and the third with a black oil stick. They're ready for a fight.
What's striking here is how quickly they default to aggression and judgment, entirely based on their father's fear and the monk's outward appearance.
Cure reaction.
They charge into the pavilion, demanding to know if these strangers are human or monster, even threatening them. It's a complete bypass of any attempt at understanding, straight to confrontation.
What do you think that says about their own upbringing or worldview?
Well, probably that force is the first answer, you know. Might makes right, perhaps.
It speaks volumes, doesn't it? They're clearly accustomed to solving problems with force. And Tang Monk, bless his heart, is immediately scared stiff, dropping his rice bowl.
Oh dear, the rice bowl.
And quickly affirms they are human, not monsters. But the little princes retort that only he looks human, asserting the other three are definitely monsters.
So much for Tang Monk's reassurances.
And through all of this, comically, Su Baji just keeps on eating. It's a fantastic detail.
That's Baji all over. Total focus on the meal, completely unconcerned by the prince's bravado.
Priorities, right.
It almost says more about his true power than any flash of light. Sun Wukong and Sha Wujing, however, calmly assert their humanity, acknowledging their ugly faces, but stressing their good hearts and kind nature despite their clumsy bodies. They're almost too patient.
Well, their patience is about to be tested. The confrontation escalates rapidly from there. The second little prince, fueled by youthful arrogance, draws his rake and moves to strike Su Baji.
And this is where the dynamic truly shifts, the moment of truth, almost.
Absolutely. Baji's reaction. He just casually pulls his own rake from his waist.
Just like that. No big deal.
And this isn't just any rake. The text says it flashes with 10,000 rays of golden light and emits 1,000 strands of auspicious energy.
Wow.
Instantly sapping the prince's strength, making his hands soft and numb.
Completely overpowered.
Then Baji playfully taunts the prince, saying his rake is only fit to be my rake's grandson.
Oh, the insult added to injury. That's perfect, Baji.
It's an incredible show of effortless power, turning the tables completely.
It's not just the display of supernatural power, but the effortless, almost playful way Baji demonstrates it.
Yeah, the casualness is key.
It's the difference between a formidable opponent and someone who makes your own strength feel like a child's toy. That kind of disarming display shatters assumptions far more effectively than brute force.
Definitely.
What do you think is going through the prince's mind at that moment? Is it pure fear, or is there a flicker of realization about who these monsters truly are?
I think a light bulb just started flickering. But the lesson isn't over yet. Next, the eldest little prince, with his staff, challenges Sun Wukong.
Of course he does. Can't let his brother be shown up alone.
And Wukong, you know, he pulls his legendary golden cudgel from behind his ear.
As you do.
Makes it incredibly thick and long. Bowl thick. And 12 to 13 feet long, the text says, and then casually shoves it 3 feet deep into the ground.
Just thunk into the stone floor, probably.
Right. The sheer unimaginable weight and power of that staff is what's truly highlighted here. Wukong even offers it to the prince.
A little test.
Who, despite using all his might, cannot move it a single jot as if it were rooted to the ground.
Not even a wiggle. This scene powerfully illustrates the immense understated strength of the Monkey King.
It really does.
A power so fundamental, it simply exists without needing flashy theatrics. It just is.
And for the final confrontation, the third little prince attacks Sha Wujing with his black stick. He's going to try, right?
Your time's the charm, or maybe not.
Sha Wujing simply cleaves the attack aside and pulls out his demon-subduing staff, which glows brightly with dazzling light.
Another effortless parry, another divine weapon reveal.
Exactly. This combined, casual, overwhelming display of power leaves not only the princes, but all the officials present utterly dumbfounded and speechless.
You can just imagine the silence in the room. Jaws on the floor.
Their initial fears, their hasty judgments, are shattered by undeniable evidence of power that goes far beyond anything they could have imagined.
It's a complete 180.
Totally. The three little princes, initially arrogant and aggressive, immediately bow down together, addressing the monks as divine masters.
From attackers to supplicants in, what, 5 minutes?
They've gone from attacking to worshiping in a heartbeat.
They utter a plea. We commoners did not know you. We beg you to demonstrate your skills so we may pay homage and be taught.
Quite the turnaround.
This dramatic shift highlights the transformative power of humility when confronted with true, undeniable power and skill. Their arrogance didn't just melt, it was obliterated by an undeniable reality.
Yeah, pulverized.
It makes you wonder, is it the shock of power or the profound realization of their own misjudgment that truly shifts them? Or maybe both.
Probably a bit of both. And to cap it off, Sun Wukong, ever the showman, playfully picks up his staff with zero effort.
Like picking up a twig.
Remarking that the pavilion is too narrow for a proper display, and suggests he jump into the air to show them around. The confidence is just radiating off him.
He knows they've won them over now. Time for a little fun. This unforgettable aerial display. We've got the three princes there, and they're about to see something pretty mind-blowing from the Tang Monk's crew.
That's Sun Wukong, Zubaji, and Xiao Wujing.
And Wukong, wow, he really kicks things off. The text says he just leaps, like, 300 feet high.
Yeah, straight up.
Yeah.
Wielding his famous golden cudgel.
And the description, it's so vivid. His stick work is like scattered flower covering the top, or a yellow dragon turning around.
Mm-hmm.
Until eventually it says, you only see a sky full of rolling sticks. I mean, just picture that. Pure power, pure fluidity.
It really paints a picture, doesn't it? Well, classic martial arts imagery. And then Baji jumps in. He's not going to be left out.
Right. With his nine-pronged rake.
Yep. Doing a full body of tricks. And you get the sound effect in the text, too, like a whooshing wind.
So it's not just visual. You're meant to hear it, too. Adds this whole other layer. Different kind of skill on display.
And then comes Xiao Wujing to complete the trio. He gets up there with his demon-subduing staff.
And his moves sound, I don't know, maybe more elegant, but still incredibly powerful. Things like Phoenix facing the sun.
Oh, yeah, and hungry tiger pouncing on its prey. It's that mix, isn't it? Grace,
yeah.
But also sheer force, almost artistic.
Definitely.
And the overall effect on everyone watching, it's huge. The text calls it a true Zen scene. Extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. True Zen.
Yeah, where divine powers fill the air. So it's hitting on something deeper than just fighting skills.
It's like the skill itself becomes a kind of spiritual manifestation.
Exactly. That connection to Zen, mindfulness, seeing the ultimate reality in the action itself. It's powerful stuff.
So, okay, everyone's seen this. They're completely awestruck. What happens next? The reaction?
Well, it shifts immediately from awe to, like, aspiration.
Mm.
The princes.
Mm-mm.
Their reaction is instant and is profound.
How so?
The text says they kneel in the dust, just totally humbled. They realize their own weapons, their own skills.
Yeah.
Couldn't compare in the slightest. Imagine that feeling. Just utter inadequacy in the face of true mastery.
That's got to be a shock to the system for royalty.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it sparks this immediate, urgent desire. They want to worship them as teachers.
Right. Not just admire them, but learn from them.
Exactly. And learn their skills specifically to protect our nation. So it connects that personal awe to a sense of duty, of service.
Okay. So the princes are sold. You mentioned the whole city.
Oh, yeah. It ripples outwards.
Yeah.
Big time. The king, all the people in the Baosha Pavilion, that's the royal hall.
Right.
And just the general population. The text says, every household chanted Buddha and kowtowed. Every door offered incense and worshipped.
Wow. So this one display basically triggers a citywide religious revival.
Pretty much. People started believing, okay, from now on, the path to Bodhi, you know, enlightenment, is truly established.
The power of spectacle, huh? To just shift belief like that.
It's incredible. And it also clarifies the king's thinking. At first, he thought they were actual divine immortals.
Okay, a slight misunderstanding.
Yeah, but then he realizes it's the Kang Monk's disciples. And that somehow solidifies his belief even more. He sees their power as something real, something connected to the monk's spiritual journey.
Okay, so the performance is over. The impact is massive. Now the formal approach.
Right. The king and the three princes, they go to the Baosha Pavilion. But it's how they go that's interesting.
How that?
The text specifically notes, not in a grand procession. They just walk humbly.
Hmm. Shedding the royal pomp.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they go and bow down to the Tang monk. It's a real gesture of respect, of earnestness, not ordering them, but asking.
And what does the king ask for?
His plea is really heartfelt. He asks for his three dog sons.
Dog sons. That sounds harsh.
Huh? No, it's actually a term of, like, extreme humility. He's lowering himself and his sons to show respect.
Ah, okay. Gotcha. So he asked for his humble sons.
To learn martial arts from these guys who he now sees as immortals or Buddhas.
Makes sense after what they saw.
And then he makes this incredible offer. All the city's wealth as thanks.
The whole city's wealth.
Yep, everything. Which tells you just how valuable he thinks this knowledge is. It raises a question for us too, doesn't it? What price do we put on deep knowledge or skill today?
That's a really good point. So this huge offer is on the table. How does Wukong, the main performer, respond?
This is where it gets really interesting. Wukong just laughs heartily.
Laughs at the offer of immense wealth.
Yeah. And he basically tells the king, "Your Highness, you don't know how to do things."
Wow. Bold.
Totally.
Yeah.
And he flat out rejects the money. Says, "Do not mention any profit."
So what does he want then, if not wealth?
That's the key insight, I think. He says the real basis for teaching for this kind of relationship isn't profit. It's affection and good intentions.
Affection and good intentions.
Yeah. Sincerity.
Yeah.
Genuine connection. He's basically saying you can't buy this kind of wisdom, this kind of mentorship. It has to come from the right place, from the heart.
That is surprisingly profound, especially coming from, well, a monkey known for causing trouble.
Right. It's a powerful lesson about value, completely turning the king's assumptions upside down.
So Wukong agrees to teach, but on his own terms. How do the princes react to that?
Oh, they're overjoyed. Forget the money. They got what they wanted, the promise of teaching. So they immediately command a grand banquet.
A celebration.
And the text just goes all out describing it. It sounds incredible.
Give us some details. What was it like?
Okay, so the place is decorated with colorful silks. There's fragrant smoke everywhere.
Setting the mood.
Totally. Gold inlay tables, painted lacquer chairs, really top-notch stuff.
And the food, I bet it was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Fresh fruits, fragrant tea, sweet snacks, clean and abundant steamed buns. And special things like steamed pastries with honey, things fried with oil, sweetened with syrup. Just sounds delicious.
Making me hungry just listening. What about drinks?
Equally fancy. Fragrant, glutinous vegetarian wine that's described like jade liquid.
Jade liquid, wow.
And Yangtzean immortal tea that apparently smells better than cinnabar laurel. So the best of the best, basically. A feast truly fit for, well, enlightened beings.
It really sounds like they pulled out all the stops to show gratitude.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just eating and drinking. There was entertainment, too.
Oh, like what?
Singing, dancing, playing instruments, performing plays, the whole nine yards. And it went on all day long.
A proper festival, then. A celebration of this newfound hope and connection.
Exactly. It was a massive show of the kingdom's gratitude and this kind of new spiritual energy they felt.
And then after all that, they arrange beds for them right there in the pavilion.
Yep. Comfortable beds in the Baosha Pavilion.
Huh.
So they're treated as honored guests, staying right there, ready for the lessons to begin the next morning. Sets the stage perfectly.
And what's striking right away is this change in, well, etiquette.
Absolutely. It shifts from the formal royal ceremony, the royal line, to what's called shili, a teacher-student ceremony.
So the princes are basically acknowledging these guys as masters, right? Straight off the bat.
Exactly. It shows this immediate reverence, this recognition of a different kind of authority.
Mm.
And that respect, well, it turns into massive curiosity about the disciples' power.
Yeah, they don't hang about. They ask to see the weapons, even try them out.
And Pigsy, you know, typical Pigsy, he just kind of tosses his nine-tooth rake onto the ground.
Just like that. And Sandy leans his staff against a wall. Mm. Pretty casual.
But the weight, that's the kicker. Pigsy's rake, 5,048 jin.
Wow.
And Sandy's staff, the exact same. 5,048 jin. We're talking thousands and thousands of pounds here.
Seriously? That much? Can you imagine trying to lift something like that?
Well, the second and third princes try. And the text gives this great image, like dragonflies shaking stone pillars.
Huh.
They apparently turn redheaded and red-faced, straining, but can't move them half an inch.
So it's instantly clear these aren't just, you know, sticks and farming tools.
Not even close. And the eldest prince gets it right away. He calls them Shen Bing divine weapons.
Divine weapons. Okay. So that sets the stage.
It really does. It establishes this almost immovable superhuman quality before Monkey King even shows his hand.
Right. And Monkey King's reveal, that's different, isn't it? Not just dropping it on the floor.
Oh, completely different. He takes this tiny, like, needle-sized thing out of his ear.
From his ear. Still amazing.
Isn't it? And as soon as it hits the wind, boom, it grows to be bowl thickness and stands there straight up.
Whoa. Okay, so what's the reaction to that?
Predictable, maybe. The king, the officials, they're all frightened. Every official is startled.
I bet.
And the princes, of course, are immediately asking, why'd it come from your ear? How does it just grow like that?
And Monkey King doesn't hold back on the explanation, does he? He gives this whole epic history.
Oh, yeah. It's quite poetic. He says it was forged when chaos first divided.
Chaos first divided. So this isn't just a weapon. It's practically primordial.
Exactly. It's tied into the very foundations of their cosmos. He says, Great Yu, you know, the legendary flood controller, personally said it.
Great you. Wow. What was it used for originally?
Measuring the depths of lakes, seas, and rivers. And later, helping open mountains and control floods. Basically, a tool for shaping the world in times of peace.
That's incredible. So it had this civic purpose, almost.
Initially, yeah.
Yeah.
Then it ended up in the East Ocean, guarding the sea gates.
Okay.
And it has inherent magic. It emits glowing rays. It can shrink, grow, and be pristine. It's alive, in a way.
And Monkey says he was destined to get it right.
Old Sun was destined to obtain it, yeah. And it transforms in countless ways with incantations. It responds to him.
So it's not just a heavy stick, it's interactive.
Very much so. It can expand to fill the universe or shrink to a needle tip. Its name, the As You Will golden hooped rod.
As You Will. Perfect.
He calls it peerless in heaven and on earth. And the weight. Even more staggering.
Okay, hit me with it.
13,500 jin.
13,000. That's more than double the other two combined.
Yep. It really shows the hierarchy there, doesn't it? This weapon is in a class of its own.
Definitely reflects Monkey King's own status. He goes on about its abilities too, right? Changing thickness, appearing, disappearing.
And its history. Wreaking havoc in heaven, attacking the underworld, subduing tigers and dragons, sweeping away monsters.
The greatest hits tour?
Pretty much. He says, just lifting it can darken the sun and make heaven and earth's ghosts and spirits tremble.
Yikes.
And he's very clear. This comes from primordial immortal transmission. It is definitely not mortal iron.
So, yeah. Cosmic history, ancient myths, universal power, all wrapped up in this one staff from his ear.
It really underlines that it's more than a tool. It's an extension of him, tied to the very fabric of their reality.
Unsurprisingly, the princes are, well, blown away.
Totally awestruck. They worship ceaselessly and basically beg for instruction. Teach us.
But Monkey King's a bit hesitant, isn't he? He's cautious.
He is. He points out they just don't have the strength yet. He worries they might draw a tiger but end up with a dog.
Meaning they'll try but kind of mess it up?
Exactly. Fail to get the real effect. He even quotes a proverb about teaching needing to be strict and learning needing effort.
So it's not just about showing them the moves.
No, it seems to go deeper.
Wow.
This raises a really interesting question. What is this divine strength he talks about needing to impart first?
Right. It sounds like a prerequisite. Like you need a fundamental change before you can even start learning the techniques.
It suggests a kind of mystical transformation, something beyond just hitting the gym. Changes their very nature, perhaps.
Seems like it. So his condition is, first, show sincerity, burn incense, worship heaven and earth. Then he'll impart some divine strength.
And the princes are thrilled. They immediately get the incense table ready, do the whole worship thing.
And then Monkey King, showing respect, goes to Tripitaka, bows, thanks him for his own rescue, and formally asks permission to teach these guys.
Noting they'd be Tripitaka's grand disciples, which is a nice touch.
Yeah. And Pigsy and Sandy jump in, too. They bow, admit they're not great teachers, clumsy tongues, but they want to teach disciples, too, kind of show off and leave a legacy.
And Tripitaka is happy to let them all do it.
So this imparting of divine strength, how does that actually happen?
It's very ritualistic.
Yeah.
Monkey King takes the princes to a quiet room, draws a magical formation.
Ooh.
Tells them to lie down, prostrate, meditating with closed eyes and calm spirits.
And then he does his thing. Secretly.
Exactly. Secretly chanting true words, reciting spells. He blows immortal ku into their hearts and stomachs.
Immortal ki.
Wow.
Yeah, gathers their original spirits, imparts secret formulas. It's described as a method of shedding the mortal coil and exchanging bones.
So like a total internal overhaul, almost like alchemy.
Precisely. It involves circulating their ki in a full cycle, the Ziwu Zushan, a complete energetic reset.
And the result?
Instant power boost. They get tens of thousands of jin of strength.
Tens of thousands, so they can handle the weapons now.
Seems so. They wake up feeling refreshed, spirits high, strong bones, and sturdy muscles.
Do they try the weapons?
Immediately. The eldest lifts the golden hoop rod. The second, Pigsy's rake. The third, Sandy's staff. They can do it.
Amazing. The king must have been over the moon.
Boundless joy, the text says. He throws a big vegetarian feast to thank everyone.
But there's always a but, isn't there? How does the actual practice go?
Well, during the feast, they try some moves. And yeah, they can do them, but they get breathless really quickly. They can't endure.
Ah. So they have the strength, but not the stamina or something else.
It seems like it's more about the magic of the weapons. The source says the weapons transformations, how they change size, attack, defend, those are natural subtleties.
Things mortals can't just pick up overnight.
Exactly. They've got the brawn, the raw power input, but they lack the innate connection, the mastery of the weapon's own magical nature.
It's like getting a supercar, but only knowing how to drive it in first gear.
That's a great analogy. It really highlights that gap between bestowed power and true inherent mastery. They can hold the tool, but they don't fully understand its way.
Which, okay, leads us to the next kind of ironic development.
Right. The next day, the princes are practical. They admit they're struggling with the weapons conversions, the magical changes.
So what's their solution?
Let's get copies made. Lighter versions, using the originals as models.
Sensible enough, I guess. What did the disciples think?
Pigsy loves the idea. He's like, yeah, absolutely. We need our real ones for demon fighting. You guys need practice versions. Good plan.
Okay, so the plan is set. They get blacksmiths by, what, 10,000 jin of steel?
Yep. Set up a forge right there in the courtyard. Smelt the steel. Everything's ready.
And then comes the mistake. The big one.
The critical error. Right. Monkey King, Pigsy, and Sandy. They place their priceless divine weapons outside in the forge area.
Just leave them there overnight while the work goes on.
Day and night, the text says. Just sitting there, serving as models.
Oh, boy. You can see where this is going. That just sounds like asking for trouble.
Well, these aren't just lumps of metal. They're divine. So what do they do when left out? They glow.
Of course they do.
Emit tens of thousands of rosy rays piercing the sky and thousands of auspicious ki covering the ground. Basically a giant magical beacon.
Like a giant steel me sign written in celestial light.
Pretty much.
Yes.
And sure enough, 70 limps away, on Leopard Head Mountain and Tiger Mouth Cave, a demon sees the light show and feels, quote, desire.
Oh, dear.
Sees the weapon's radiating power, swoops in with a surge of power, and snatches all three, then heads back to his cave.
All three. Just like that, their most powerful artifacts, gone.
Gone. And the commentary in the text right after is so pointed. The way cannot be separated for a moment. What can be separated is not the way.
Meaning you can't separate the power from its true purpose or wielder?
Or you lose it. Divine weapons are all lost and the cultivator's efforts are wasted. A stark lesson in oversight.